Eddie Wallace Reel 3. How did you feel about going from infantry to artillery?
Well, it was a slower discipline. Although, of course, marching drills and all that were exactly the same, but it was more friendly, more personal, shall I say, more personal. And I didn't mind it because all my family were gunners anyway. My grandfather, my father, a couple of uncles were gunners as well. So that didn't worry me in the least. Actually, I'd wanted to go originally when I went before the medical in the October of 1942. I wanted to go into the Royal Marines, and I went down to the recruiting office down at Victoria Cinema, went before a medical board there, and the chairman of that medical board was a Dr. Dove. Now, he knew me because I had dealt with him as a police officer a few weeks previous, and I was graded B1. He knew that I wanted to go in the Royal Marines, but I was graded B1, and I was sent down to the floor below to the Army recruiting office there for their medical board. And nothing wrong with you, you're A1. Of course, I couldn't get into the Royal Marines, so in the Army. And I asked for another medical when I, later on, when I went into the 232 regiment, just to make sure that I was all right. And yes, I was A1. My own police surgeon graded me as A1 as well. So
why did he grade you as B1?
Well, he was getting his own back at me. Yeah, Dr. Dove. He had a surgery in Victoria Road South, not far from Albert Road Police Station, and I had dealings with him. I won't say for what type of dealings, but he's dead and gone now, unfortunately.
And then, what was your next step? Because you were at Arbourfield now.
Yes, Arbourfield. The nearest pub was the... what was that pub called? The Bram's Hill Hunt, which was always packed out, naturally. You had a cinema on the... on the parade ground there, alongside the parade ground there, and the naffy. But other than that, you were miles from anywhere. In fact, my wife, who was then my girlfriend, came up to Reading on a typing examination course when she was in the NFS by then, and she came out to Arbourfield, wandering around the area there, you know. But there was nothing there. I couldn't take her anywhere. There was nowhere to go.
How did you get on with the artillery pieces you had to do with that?
Okay, yes, I was put on mainly 3.7s. And having been there after my initial 6 weeks, we were taught radio location as well, all about radar, operator fire control, as they called them. When postings came up for a particular regiment, I found that I was being posted to the 86th Regiment Royal Artillery, which was then stationed at Mushroom Farm Camp, Wethersfield, near Braintree in Essex. I was made an acting, unpaid Lance Bombardier, one tape. I think really it was solely to take up five members of the 232 training regiment who were joining the 86 with me, to take them up via Waterloo, you know, on the train from Wokingham, Guildford, then Waterloo, over the other side to Braintree, that was it. And got to Wethersfield. Well, got to Braintree, no transport there. I rang up for transport, having been given the address of the regiment, and got transport down, and found ourselves, I'll say, a mushroom farm, and they called it Mushroom Farm Camp. It consisted solely of Nissen huts, no windows or anything like that. They grew mushrooms there, a concrete floor. That was the original idea, and of course the army had taken it over as a camp. I found it was the Honourable Artillery Company, one of the regiments supplied by the HAC. They supplied, let me see, they had the 11th, 12th and 13th, and the 86th regiments, the HAC did. And strange it might seem, I've been a member of that regiment ever since. Even now, I'm a member of that regiment, a member of the company. The 86th, of course, was disbanded. But I belong to the company.
What kind of a regiment was the 86th?
It was a mobile 37 anti-aircraft regiment. And we dealt with everything. Anti-personnel, anti-tank. It was anti-aircraft. It made a good name for itself, apparently, during the raids on London. Of course, I wasn't with the regiment then, so I wouldn't know. But their history, which I have up top there in the book, tells me all about it. Their history in London. Very, very good.
And then?
Well, then, we continued training, of course, all the time. And being a mobile unit, we were dashing all over the United Kingdom. Not only training, but also if a place was thought was going to be attacked, then we would go up there. Scotland, Dumbarton. The First Army sailed from there, and we went up there to give cover in case Jerry got wind of it. I can see now in my mind's eye, looking down and seeing the Queen Mary down there, all painted grey. Other big ships, all painted grey, as well as battleships, destroyers and what have you. And one morning, looking down again, everything had gone. And it was then we discovered, of course, that it was the Operation Torch, the invasion of North Africa. We didn't know at that particular time what it was all about.
Did the enemy attack?
No.
At Dumbarton?
No. No. No, they didn't. They hadn't a clue. They hadn't a clue. Well, as far as we know, they didn't have a clue anyway. No air raids were in operation there. But, we were all over the country. Clacton, Swanage, Blandford, oh my goodness, yes, Salisbury Plain, they built barges out of concrete, and we were unloading and loading, practicing unloading and loading our guns, vehicles, on and off these barges, these concrete barges.
This was at Blandford?
At Blandford.
In a river?
Blandford is on Salisbury Plain. Big army camp there. Oh, yes. The Paris took it over eventually. But that was a big army camp there.
So these weren't floating barges? These were concrete barges?
No, made of concrete on the plain, on Salisbury Plain. And we were just practicing. I mean, they were made to the measurements of the real barges. We were practicing on and off, on and off, on and off there. And it so happened that most of them were landing craft tank. And when we did eventually go over, we went on LSTs landing.
During this period, did you defend any cities or towns from air attack?
Yes, Southampton.
What do you remember about that?
Being on the common, that's all I can recall about that, gun emplacement on the common. We were in private houses there, and we'd taken over private houses in Shirley. There. And I remember on one occasion when we were at Blandford, incidentally, we were called down to Swanage. And went operational there. There was a big exercise on, and it wasn't until it was all over that we realised, or we were told, that we were defending Churchill, Eisenhower and Montgomery, who were observing this particular exercise at Swanage. Also, whilst we were there, we had to meet Montgomery, or he met us, really speaking. We were called out, I can't remember it was now, but with Canadians and other troops, and he came along the lines, walked along the lines, and I can always remember, it was a short man, very, very vivid blue eyes, very vivid blue eyes, and I can remember him saying, gather round me, and we all gathered round him, must have been a couple of thousand of us, must have been, and he had a microphone there, and as you are aware, shortly, I cannot say when, but shortly, you will be fighting the enemy. I want to know you and you to know me. Words to that effect as well.
Yeah. Where was this?
This was at I can't remember now. It was. I know we were at Blandford. I know that we were at Blandford, and it was somewhere on Salisbury Plain we were called. But it's such a long, long time ago now. You don't remember these things.
What happened next?
Not long after that, we went to Clacton, where our guns were taken away from us, and we went infantry for about 6 weeks, revitalizing our infantry training. Because, as you know, a gunner does everything. He does infantry training, infantry, tank, as well as guns. If they want somebody, they always pick upon a gunner to do it. You look at Northern Ireland now, the majority of troops there are gunners. Sierra Leone, most of those were gunners. Places like that, it's always gunners. Because they're adaptable. And, as I say, we were at Clacton, Butlins Holiday Camp. We took that over there. I always remember I went for a swim in the swimming pool there, and I got rollicked by the Sergeant Major, by the Battery Sergeant Major. I shouldn't have gone for a swim in that. That water was being kept solely to fight fires in case the place had got burned. Ah, well. Yeah. From then, halfway through May, I suppose, will be 1944. We were taken down to Essex. We went to Essex to a place called Avebury. A-V-E-B-U-R-Y.
In Essex. This is not Wiltshire.
No, Essex. In Essex. And we went into a camp there with the London Scottish. They were infantry. So we thought, hello, are we going to go over as infantry this time? You know, why are we with the London Scottish? And all of a sudden, barbed wire appeared all the way around the camp. Red caps, blue caps with dogs patrolling outside. Nobody was allowed to leave. Nobody would come in. No mail was allowed to be written. We were just intense. And I can recall on one occasion a sergeant of the London Scottish giving a talk on how to make harmless a German teller mine. And the blasted thing blew up on him, let him in bits, and two or three of his companions that were with him. And that body, those bits, being paraded around the camp in a wheelbarrow so that everybody could see what a teller mine does to you. Well, it didn't affect me, but it did affect quite a number of people. It didn't affect me because I'd seen so much of it before anyway. But it was then we realised, obviously, that we were going somewhere.
In what way did it affect the spectators?
Well, a lot of them went back into their tents and were violently sick. I can tell you that they were sick, really sick. Yeah. I don't know if you, perhaps I'm being personal there, but if you've ever seen or been near a body that's in bits, the smell from it is rather odious. And that's what it was like. Of course, it's all burnt as well. Yeah. But
did anybody complain about it?
No, we didn't complain about it. Gracious me, no. And then on June the 2nd, we. Sorry, my wife is out there. I hope. On June the 2nd, 44, we mounted up in our matadors. We had matadors. Hitched up the 37s and travelled a few miles to Tilbury. It's only just down the road, Tilbury. So that's where Avery is. It's not far. Incidentally, we found out whilst we were at Avery that it was where the 1st Battalion, the HAC, formed up for the First World War and went over to France from there. But... we went to Tilbury Docks. The public knew what was going on more than we did. They were there cheering us and waving us, and chocolates and sweets being thrown at us by our own people. And then, of course, you could realise there was rationing on too in those days. And we went on board a landing ship tank, an LST, an American one. And... that same day, I think it was the same day, night time, we left Tilbury, went down the Thames, through Dover Straits. Why Jerry never had a go at us there, I don't know. More than one ship, of course. I mean, it was, must have been about a dozen of us, I suppose. A dozen LSTs going down with an escort of MTBs. And we came down to Portsmouth here, my hometown, and we were anchored near Spitsand Fort. Now, from Spitsand Fort, you could see the whole of the seafront, Portsmouth seafront, and the Royal Beach Hotel by Southbury Pier had been taken over by the local authority as civic offices because the Guildhall had gone up, and my father was on duty there with a First World War 4-5 revolver slung round his shoulder to have a go at any Germans that landed, which is bloody ridiculous, of course. But I borrowed a pair of binoculars, and I could see my father outside the beach hotel occasionally come out for a bit of fresh air in uniform. Of course, he didn't know I was there, of course. It was my dad. Yeah. And we were due to sail... on the 4th, but it was put back a day, so in actual fact we sailed on the 5th, on the evening of the 5th. Very choppy, I can remember that, very very choppy going over. We were allowed freedom on board the LST, and until we got what, within shooting range, I suppose, of the beach, you know, where the beaches were not all that far off the following morning, when we were locked down below. I suppose it must have been, we must have been quite a bit away from those beaches, and then it must have been about 30 miles away from those beaches when they did that. We weren't allowed to go up top at all, except some of the gunners manned the troop ships, the ship's guns, for ACAC purposes. They only pom-poms and machine guns, things like that. You hear what was going on around, and it was about 8:30 on the morning of the 6th when we grounded, the red light was on down below, that suddenly turned to green. The siren went, the bows opened, and then we went. The first vehicle to go down was a Jeep. I have an idea at the back of my mind there that it contained Robinson, Major Robinson, Captain Nuttall, who was a 2IC, and someone, and a couple of sergeants. I can't think who they were now. But it disappeared. The ship had landed, grounded on the bomb crater as it got down. So we, you probably know that when LSTs come in, or any landing ship come in, you drop out a stern anchor and you let you pull yourself back onto the sea by that anchor, you see. Well, that's what happened on this occasion. We backed out and came in again and unloaded our stuff then and there. Mind you, this was the second wave, 8:30 in the morning, on Mike Green Beach at a place called Cosel, Burnie-sur-Mer. Burnie-sur-Mer. The landing beach was codenamed Mike Green. And I always remember this, that we landed at 8:28 when our time was 8:30. And I heard afterwards that the colonel got a rollicking from the beach master because it put his timetable 8. We landed 2 minutes before we should have done. And that was a commander in the Royal Navy. He was a beach master there. But we took off 137, and the ship backed out a bit. I understood afterwards that we were with the 3rd Canadian Division then, and the Regiment de la Chandelle, a French Canadian regiment, had landed one side of us, and the Royal Winnipeg Rifles the other side. And the French Canadians were holed up in an orchard, not all that far away from the beach, and they were being kept down by a German 88, which was in the middle of the road at Bernier, and that they wanted him blasted away. There were no field guns available at that particular beach, and they called upon a 3-7. Of course, it's mobile 3-7. We went with anti-tank, anti-personnel, everything. And the gun that went ashore, I wasn't on that gun, but the gun that went ashore dealt with that 88, blew it up. I've always said all along that a 3-7 ACAT gun was far better than the German 88mm, far better. An 88 gun did not have a 360-degree line of fire, but a 3-7 did. And the mechanics of working both guns are exactly the same on wheels.
Were you under fire personally when you landed on the beach?
When we landed on the beach, yes, we were. And we found that it was coming from a little to our left, just the other side of the mouth of the Orme, Merville Battery. They had a gun there. They hadn't taken it at that particular time. And that was plastering the beach.
Were they big shells?
Oh, yes, yes. As far as I can recall, they're 11-inch. It was in the gun was in a, I found out afterwards this, of course, that it was in a tunnel, and it used to come out, shell, go back in again, so you couldn't see it.
Were they causing many casualties?
Yes, they were. Yeah, yes, they were causing quite a bit of casualties. In fact, the French-Canadian regiment, quite a, and the Queen's, Royal Queen's regiment, a Canadian regiment, they lost a good third of their personnel on that beach.
So was your
through the this gunfire.
Was your own beach landing frightening?
Very apprehensive. I wasn't frightened. I wasn't frightened, I don't think. Very apprehensive. I suppose I was frightened. It'd be silly to say I wasn't. But I know I was very apprehensive as to what was going to happen to me. And strange as it may seem, I've been back there since, and I've located the exact spot where we landed. There's a Canadian War Memorial there now.
What equipment did you personally take onto the beach?
I personally took a 3-7 onto the beach and some radar equipment.
And what rank did you have?
I was a sergeant. I was up and down. I kept up and down like a yo-yo. Bombardier to sergeant, back again. simply because I was more substantiated.
So, which troop and battery were you in?
I was in 383 Battery, E Troop. E Troop, 383 Battery, 86th Regiment.
And did the handling of your equipment go smoothly?
Yes, yes, it did. It went smoothly. A passageway had been blown in the promenade there for us to get up. Royal Engineers had laid a track. This is only after the first wave had gone in, too, Mark. You know, at 6:30, I suppose, the first wave went in. And in the 2 hours, Royal Engineers had done marvellous work. They'd taken off a load of the mines, landmines that were attached to the spiked obstacles on the beach, taken off those. And they'd laid a track for us to go through. They'd blown up a hole, you know, in the prom there. Laid a track. And there was a Royal Military policeman doing traffic duty on top. White cuffs, red cap. He didn't have a helmet on, red cap. He had his helmet on his shoulder. Yeah, traffic duty, as if he was in Piccadilly Circus or somebody, you know. That man. Of course, the infantry had gone on before, as you appreciate. The first wave had gone on. And I suppose you know that the drill is, you don't bother about stuff either side of you when you land. You go straight ahead. You aim for the stuff ahead of you. You follow on parties. Deal with the stuff either side. And then when reinforcements come, they go through the centre again. And then that lot that was in the centre at first go out. So you're forward and eight all the time. Not being an infantryman, but that's the general principle.
What else do you remember happening to you on D-Day?
Well, I can remember us being shot at by some women. We got to a place called Duvers, D-O-U-V-R-E-S, Duvers. And we were shot at by women there. But I didn't deal with that side of it. The battery sergeant major sent some chaps from the where were they from? Was it from the predictor? Anyway, he sent some chaps to deal with them. So what happened with that lot, I don't know. I just don't know. All I know is that we were shot at by French women. You could see them shooting at us. I presume they got tied up with Germans, I suppose, you know, German men. And
how many of them?
It was either three or four of them.
What were they using to fire?
German Rosers.
Did they hit anybody?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge.
From what distance were they firing?
I suppose about 300 yards. 300 yards. If they'd been trained to use a rifle properly, they should have hit several of us, but of course they weren't. That's it. But, I always remember, they weren't, on the whole, the people in Normandy weren't all that pleased to see us. I'm certain of that. They weren't all that pleased to see us then. Afterwards, of course, when they were liberated, they're all over you. Even now, you go over there, can't do enough for you. But deep down, I think they knew what was going to happen to their villages, their townships and all that. It was going to be flattened. And they were doing very well under the Germans anyway. No, I don't think they wanted this, but as you went further up into Northern France, Belgium, yes, you're welcome, really welcomed with open arms. And let me drop something. And especially into Holland as well. They really welcomed you up there. But
what kind of experiences did you have in Normandy after D-Day?
When Caen was supposed to have fallen, we sent the battery down to Kapake Airport, which was the airport to Khan, and we went anti-tank shooting there and anti-personnel shooting there, so that the infantry could go in and then do house-to-house fighting. But other than that, I can't recall much about what happened in France now. We went up to Le Havre with the Canucks.